The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Even as the Russians edge forward in eastern Ukraine, over the past few months, Ukrainian forces have been solidifying their occupation of parts of the Kursk region, actually inside Russia itself. Over the weekend, Ukrainian forces intensified their offensive in the region, gaining tactical advantage in multiple sectors and inflicting, we're told, major casualties on Russians and perhaps two on North Koreans. And while Ukraine is prospering in one area of the conflict, the Russian economy is worsening because of inflation and incredibly high interest rates, standing now at 21%. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Patrick Bury, Senior Associate Professor in Warfare and Counterterrorism at the University of Bath, himself a former NATO analyst. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, you don't get too much good news for the Ukrainian forces in recent times, but this activity in Kursk seems to demonstrate they're still very much in the game.
It is, yeah. I mean, like, we don't want to overblow this. It is a tactical advance, essentially, Pat, but they have been on the back foot. Back in August, they captured about 1,000 square kilometres of the Kursk salient, and that's since been reduced by about half by the Russians' repeated attacks and then increasingly with the North Koreans. And what the Ukrainians have done over the weekend, essentially, is to, and during the week, is to use their electronic warfare to blind Russian drones and then use HIMARS and infantry to attack a few villages south of the main town that they're holding in that salient. So they've taken some ground, and it is a bit of a surprise. It's certainly taken the Russians and North Koreans there by surprise, but it's not really a major gain yet. I think it's designed to show that they can attack to the incoming Trump administration.
The casualty toll seems to be incredibly high for the Russians.
It does, yeah. I mean, they've been taking, due to their constant attacks further south in the Donetsk region, they've been taking between 1,000 and 1,500 killed and wounded a day. So you're talking at somewhere between 30,000 and 45,000 a month. It's some of the heaviest they've actually taken since the start of the war. But nevertheless, they can continue to replace those, not with, you know, trained, organized professional troops, but with conscripts who are essentially offered a lot of money to sign up. And they're replacing them to the tune of about 30,000 a month. So in the longer term, they can still kind of sustain this further than the Ukrainians can, unfortunately.
Now, you can look at the populations and say the Russians can provide more troops, but there's bound to be a point when, you know, maybe the mothers and even the fathers of Russia say, I don't want my boys going there.
You'd hope so, but, you know, writing off Russian ability to sustain casualties is a lesson that history has told us not to do. So I'd be quite cautious about that. You know, the same thing happened when their professional army was wiped out in the first year of the war. You know, but they've managed to take it and they've sustained themselves and moved on. And plus, you know, they're being offered huge, huge signing on bonuses, which for people who have few options in terms of employment or making money, if they survive, they're quite considerable. So, and you've got to remember there's also an information, damp down/blackout where, you know, getting information from the front is more difficult. It's not like this is on an open media environment. So I think, unfortunately, you know, the idea that the Russian military may collapse is probably less likely than the economy might start to overheat and force some decisions. But we'll just have to wait and see about that, you know.
Now, it's expected that some attempts to broker a ceasefire will happen when Trump gets into office. Trump doesn't really have a lot of time for the Ukrainians and Zelensky. But at the same time, you wonder, does he want to give a win to Putin, the perception of a win to Putin, because he's a proud, vainglorious man, and I don't think he would like to see himself characterized in that way.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Trump's interested in the art of the deal, and he wants to be seen as cutting a major deal on the global stage. I don't think he wants to be seen as a loser. So that means that, he wants to make them the deal which is seen both to, I think, the world and to Russia and Ukrainians is that it's not a win for Putin, because he doesn't want to be seen as a loser. Now, the question is whether there's all this emphasis now on that it seems like the direction of travel is there will be a deal, and certainly Ukraine has moved a bit towards that too as a result of Trump's win. But I still think there's some major questions to be answered, and I'd be cautious because Russia has the momentum on the battlefield. Their military is kind of able to sustain these casualties at the, in the short to medium term anyway. And why would they cut a deal now when they have the momentum? And Ukraine is clearly struggling. So I think, you know, and Putin is a man who, you know, understands strength, the position of strength, using your enemy's weakness from judo, you know, against them, or their strengths against them too. So I'm a little bit more cautious and sanguine than other people are about a deal. Hopefully one would come along, and Keith Kellogg has provided some of the outlines. That's Trump's envoy to Ukraine, some of the outlines of what the US are looking for.
And what are they?
Essentially, Pat, it's about freezing the lines where they are, and then Ukraine signing up to basically stating that there's no accession to NATO in the short to medium term, at least, and in return for a peace deal, sanctions would gradually be lifted on Russia too. So it's basically freezing the conflict and kicking the can down the road. The question is whether Putin, you know, with his economy under pressure, with his population mobilizing, with quite good control of the population now, you know, compared to before the war, better control, whether he would abide by a ceasefire, would he just wait for another opportunity and potentially go again?
Now, the question of the economy, interest rates at 21%, and Putin, in effect, can control the central bank and tell them not to raise the interest rates again, which they wanted to do, up to 23%. But business complaining, we can't afford this.
Yeah, well, the general, I'm not an economist, so, you know, I'm more in the security side of things. But what you're seeing from those that sort of do defense economies is on Russia is that they're saying that come the summer, on the current trajectories, the Russian economy will be in quite a vulnerable position. The sanctions are having an effect, just slower than normal. The economy has been put about 75% on a war footing. There's obviously really high employment. But the question is, over the long run, is it sustainable? Now, those points I mentioned, you see, Putin is going to have to come to a choice. One is basically ceasefire, demobilize, and readjust the economy back to a more normal extractives, you know, resources-based model that provided Russia with, you know, good enough growth for the last 20 years at least. The question is, if he does that strategically, what happens to the demob soldiers? They may well come back with a lot of problems, angry about how they've been treated. Does Russia have the resources to basically reintegrate those and the will? And secondly, what happens to the... And so there's an increased risk of political unrest. And secondly, what happens to the economy? Is it able to be, you know, dampened down in that way, in a controlled manner? So they're the big questions he has. And he may, you know, one of the things I think about here was Adolf Hitler, when he, you know, got the German economy onto a better footing as a result of war. As a result of investing in his military, it was an easy way out, and then had to use that military. So there's a question of actually, is it a greater risk for Putin to end this war or not? And I think that's something that the economy, of course, and the question is playing.
Now, the war economy, obviously making artillery shells and equipment and so on, that is obviously a big business. But we're hearing reports that, you know, tanks absent on the field of battle, and instead they're using things like Hummers, non-strictly military equipment to get around, and whether or not they can continue to manufacture things like the high-grade steel barrels for the tank weapons.
Yeah, that's it. And the tank production isn't that great. And they've been taking stuff out of storage, of course, and throwing old things in as they've been losing them. But on the other hand, they are maintaining and even increasing their cruise and ballistic missile capability, more high-tech stuff, which is having a major effect on the Ukrainian energy infrastructure and on the war itself. So I just, my take here is, yes, some elements, of course, are under strain. They've managed to increase, like the Ukrainians have done a great job in increasing the drone production, you know, so the Russians are slowly managing that. They've got into better dynamic targeting, which is matching your drone footage with your artillery or other, you know, ballistic cruise missile strikes. So, of course, you know, we're nearly 3 years in. Things have improved both sides. But I don't, and certainly around tanks and you know, the machining of steel barrels, etc., like that, yes. But in other areas, they're managing to compensate. So my lesson is, having watched, you know, Russia, certainly in the Second World War, they can take losses and they generally can grind things out. And secondly, the standards that they expect for things is not as high as maybe what the West would expect.
Well, I suppose maybe what Napoleon learned and Hitler learned, are they expecting Zelensky to learn the same lessons? I mean, he is, I suppose, cut from part of the same cloth that the Russians are cut from. So maybe there's steel there too. By the way, this, back where we started about Kursk and the gains being made, small though they may be, by the Ukrainians inside Kursk, there's some speculation and concern that this is a diversionary tactic by the Ukrainians who've something else up their sleeve.
Well, I've seen that, and I would look, the Ukrainians are great at surprising us, even those who watch it closely, like Kursk, you know, the first time back in August. I would be even more surprised if they did, because they're under such pressure in terms of their mobilization and their resources that they have. So if they've managed to keep some units back that are ready to go, properly equipped and ready for offensive operations with the command and logistics elements, I would be very surprised given the pressure they're under. I think Kursk was that surprise, but you never know. But again, I'd say the likelihood is relatively slim given the conditions on the front line. What I would say, Pat, it's not all doom and gloom. Like, on the other hand, you know, Ukraine, if you think about what a nation is, it's basically a community forged in arms against another, often its neighbour. And Ukraine, as a sort of nation state now going forward, I think is already at the strategic level one. You know, it's not going to, barring some sort of disaster or collapse, it's not going to be in Russian orbit, whether it's in NATO or not. I think that at the strategic level is already won, and it kind of actually won within, you know, a few months of the Russian invasion when it repelled it.
Patrick Bury, Senior Associate Professor in Warfare and Counterterrorism at the University of Bath, former NATO analyst, thank you very much for joining.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.